Well, like Mr. Calton, I've taken the opportunity to jot down some points rather than rely on a memory which is not what it was. But I've only got half a page, so need not be unduly dismayed. Before I start reminiscing or rambling, and perhaps both terms will be applied to my remarks, I have to thank you all for the very generous gift and for the way in which you've come along this afternoon. There's an old phrase, it sounds a bit old-fashioned now. People used to speak of doing me the honour. I think you've done me an honour this afternoon in coming along and doing me an honour now, listening to my remarks. In addition to thanking the staff as a whole, I, of course, have to thank the support which I've had from the English staff over the years. I've rarely had any occasion, as I think Mr. Davis has mentioned, to find myself in the unfortunate position of disagreeing with my colleagues. But when such occasions have occurred, and they've been few and far between, I think I managed to resolve matters fairly harmoniously. I think the one time which was a bit of a strain in this respect was when the two schools were amalgamated. At that time, of course, the gentleman in charge of the English department at the then Roper School had a rather anguished view of the situation. In fact, when I first met him to discuss the affairs, he seemed to be in such a state of agitation that I thought he must have been convinced in his own mind that he'd been sentenced to death and the date of execution had been fixed for September. However, by one of those strange interventions of fate, which perhaps are some indication of a divine presence, there was a complete transformation of the scene. He, at the very last moment, when everybody thought it impossible, obtained another post and left. And we were then blessed with the arrival of Mr. Wilcoxon, who has carried on at the law school ever since, very successfully, and has worked extremely well with me. And to him and his staff down there, and to the members of my staff up here, I must give my most earnest thanks. I've also got an announcement to make. Mr. Wally Hicking, whom we all know as a generous person at the end of term, is providing a beer fest, or whatever you call it, on Friday afternoon at the close of school. I shall be pleased to contribute a certain amount of sherry to the proceedings, and in order that the procession of cars through the gate at 4:30, 5 o'clock, or whatever time it is, shall not be too spasmodic. And Mrs. Staples has very kindly arranged to provide some food to absorb something of the alcohol being imbibed. And everybody present here, and indeed everyone on the staff, is invited to come along to this, I think, very, very pleasant occasion. After 3 o'clock, that is, on Friday afternoon. I've listened to Mr. Davis and Mr. Carlton, and as I was listening, I remembered a gentleman who bore the same surname as myself in the 18th century, Mr. John Hough. He became Bishop of Winchester. He lived to the great age of 93, and Dr. Johnson, that dominating literary figure of the century, referred to him as the saintly Hough. Now, I'm quite sure I shall never be Bishop of Winchester, and I very much doubt if I shall live to the age of 93. But listening to Mr. Calton, particularly this afternoon, I have more or less convinced myself that I have acquired the third distinction. But having thought about that, I then remembered another saying of Dr. Johnson's, which is to the effect that in lapidary inscriptions, by which we may understand at the present farewell speeches, a man is not upon oath. And I also remembered that Mr. Calton, as I've known him throughout the years, in particular with reference to those many collections I've made, going round with a little tin for members of staff who are leaving or getting married or doing something else extraordinary, has always contributed most lavishly. So I bear that in mind as well. Now, I've been here since 1954, but my experience of the district goes back longer than that. In 1945, I came back from the Middle East, and I found myself posted to Derby, where I was with a unit at Shelton Lock, a place which some of you may know. It's a very well-situated house that we had there. If you turned right, you were heading for the Rose and Crown at Chellaston. If you turned left, you went straight down to the Bridge Inn, kept in those days by a most rigid disciplinarian, a former sergeant major of the Sherwood Forester Regiment. And across the road, there was a most excellent cafe, kept at that time by a gentleman who painted extraordinarily good pictures and had a most attractive daughter, I remember. It was known then by the poetic title of the Traveller's Joy, a name which, as a literary man, well, it used to give my heart a lift in the morning when I passed it. The Traveller's Joy, what a poetic title. It's now changed its name, it's now known as the Golden Pheasant, which I think rather a come down. I was in the district for some months in 1945 and 1946, and I got to know it extremely well. I remember in particular that towards the end of, the middle of 1946, I was informed that the house which I occupied at the time was to be handed back to its civilian owners, and I was given the alternative of either going into barracks, which I viewed with great disfavour, or finding private lodgings for which the War Department would pay. In this situation, I enlisted the help of the local police sergeant. He came along and drank a glass of whiskey, I remember, with great fervour, and promised that he would certainly find me suitable lodgings in the district. 3 days later, he returned, looking rather crestfallen, and said, "I'm sorry, sir, but I haven't been able to manage it. Our ladies who keeps lodgings around here is widows, mostly, and they don't take very kindly to the idea of army officers. Army officers has a certain reputation," he said. "Now, if only you'd been something else," he said, "there'd have been no trouble if you were a member of the clergy. Clergy, very respectable. But of course you ain't," he said, looking hopefully at me. And he then added, "Of course, the next most respectable thing is a teacher. Now, if you'd been a teacher, I could have fixed you up in no time." However, although I was a teacher underneath the uniform, I didn't mention it to him because I didn't think it was any use going back under those circumstances. So I didn't get into lodgings, but the next time I came into the district, I had taken great care to be a teacher and therefore eminently respectable. Instead of coming here when I began my post-war teaching career, I went to the far north, Barrow-in-Furness, where I had a senior English master who was a rigid grammarian. If you are not familiar with the nature of the gerund, and he had very peculiar views about the existence of the gerundive in English, views which I bitterly disputed with him, to such an extent that he finally gave me a little book, which was called Our Living Language, and he said, "I think you could do with the help of this." So I looked at it, and on the first page, there was a list of acknowledgements for people who had helped in the writing of the book. And amongst the names was Mr. Ward of Long Eaton County Secondary School. And that struck a chord in my memory, because when I was down here in the Army in 1946, one January morning, I was coming up Tamworth Road here, as I know it now. It was raining, misty, a typical miserable Midland outlook, greyish slate roofs, black gleaming tarmac, and we came round a bend in the road, and there I saw a most extraordinary sight, a lady who at a fleeting glimpse I thought was Britannia, holding what I then thought was a trident aloft, turned out, I found out since, to be a torch, and then on either side a great gleaming golden shell, one saying Pax and the other saying Lux. And I thought, what an astonishing example of what I might call the Edwardian imperial style of architecture. So I said to my driver, "Good heavens, what's that?" And he said, "Oh, that, sir, is the pride of the district. That is the Carnegie Library. And," he said, "next door to it is the grammar school. You have just passed through, sir, the cultural centre of Long Eaton." He should have known, because his name was Barton, and he used to drive coaches in civil life. And then, in 1951 or thereabouts, I was looking through the pages of the Times Educational Supplement, as I'm sure many of you do. I was, however, looking at the leader column, and there was a glowing leader about a headmaster in the Midlands at Long Eaton Grammar School, as it was then called, which eulogised Mr. Roberts' far-sightedness, because, of course, in 1951, the school certificate examination ceased to exist, and the new O-level system came in. Nobody could take the examination below the age of 16, and therefore it was quite obvious that a large number of pupils who had formerly left the secondary schools of this country with a certificate were going to be without any certificate. Mr. Roberts had therefore developed the idea and put it to his governors and got their approval of issuing the individual scholar with a certificate from the school itself. This had somehow attained national publicity and had been taken up by the Times Ed and was, as I say, very lavishly praised. So I thought, oh, Long Eaton, the place with the gold shells, and the chap who helps in writing grammars, and now far-sighted educationists. Oh, well, I thought it must be quite a place. 3 years later, I actually arrived here, having seen the post advertised in the Times Educational Supplement. It offered me the sum of £100 a year above the salary I was then getting to take over the English department. So I came down, had a very brief interview. I arrived about 2:30. I met various other candidates. I had to get back to Sheffield, as I told Mr. Roberts, for 6 o'clock. I was due to deliver a lecture there. And so I went in, was briefly interviewed. I left before the result was known. The following morning, such was the efficiency of the post in those days, I received a letter offering me the appointment here. And so I arrived at Long Eaton, and I've been here ever since, 24 years. The General Certificate of Education, and it looks as though I'm going out with it. We hear a lot now about the NNF proposals. I remember in 1950, when the old school certificate and higher school certificate were abolished, some of us were very critical of the fact that the subsidiary stage of the higher school certificate was done away with, because it used to be used, as far as I can see, in very much the same way that the N is going to be used in the present proposals. It seems to me that not only have I come in with the general certificate and gone out with it, but that things, so to speak, have come full circle in the meantime. And another surprising development over the years has been this. I grew up in an atmosphere in educational circles which condemned examinations. Some of you may remember that the purpose of introducing the general certificate and doing away with the old school certificate was to do away with examinations. The original proposal was that there should only be an A-level examination for university entrance. Under the pressures exerted by the Confederation of British Industries and other institutions who wanted something by which they could make judgments when assessing candidates, an O-level was put in. But I can remember in 1950 examiners being a bit worried, because they thought a source of income which had been available to them for many years marking school certificate and higher school certificate papers was going to dry up. Nothing could have been more ludicrously shown up to be wrong than the actual situation. Examinations have proliferated. When I was in the educational department at Leeds University, examinations were bad. They distorted the curriculum. They were to be done away with. They were to be replaced by a record card kept by the school, which was to be perfectly satisfactory. Now, of course, again, things have come completely round and examinations dominate everything. Nobody does anything today without expecting or wanting an examination in it. Well, I've been talking far too long. I say far too long. No doubt many of you will agree with that. But far too long for myself, really, because I think those of you who have known me, as I think Mr. Davis remarked in his opening speech, have never found me particularly communicative. There are one or two reasons for that, some of them perhaps better reasons than others. One reason I can think of course, is that I come originally by education and training from Bradford. Bradford is Yorkshire, but it's the very heart of Yorkshire, if I may say so. I remember Matthew Arnold, in one of his books, referred to a newspaper of the 19th century, which he disliked, as embodying the very dissidence of dissent and the very nonconformity of nonconformity. Well, I think Bradford embodies the very Yorkshire of Yorkshire. At least Bradfordians think so. They are very different and have no truck with people from Leeds and places like that. And one of their characteristics is, of course, a certain, sometimes brusque, taciturnity. They have other less attractive characteristics as well. We have had a number of Yorkshire people on the staff, of course, there are people on the staff today with connections in Yorkshire, and so you'll be able to judge the truth of my remarks or not. I think sometimes a certain kind of arrogance is associated with Yorkshiremen, a certain kind of self-satisfaction, which I think always very well illustrated by a story I remember of a candidate before the war for the administrative branch of the civil service appearing before the Civil Service Commission. And he was asked by one of the commissioners, "At which of our two great national centres of learning were you educated, young man?" And the young man said, without hesitation, he said, "At both, Leeds and Sheffield." Well, that kind of self-satisfaction is one characteristic of Yorkshire people. A certain taciturnity is another one, I think. But another reason, connected with my own individual task of teaching English, comes into it as well. I've always regarded words, perhaps, as to be conserved, to be treated with correctness, exactitude, not to be wasted. Some years ago, I read a book by a man called Strunk. Strunk on Style is the name of the book. I don't think it's a very popular book. I haven't seen many copies about. I did put a copy, I put two copies into the library some years ago, but some doubtless far-sighted students who are going to go a long way have gone off with Strunk, and there aren't any copies left there now. Nevertheless, the book does exist. I can see Mr. Harvey wagging his head and puffing at his pipe and looking perhaps a little sceptical, but then it's by an American, and Americans have all sorts of extraordinary names. Now, Strunk never wrote a word. He was a lecturer in English at one of the American universities, and as we all know, American education is so deplorably bad that when their pupils go up to universities, they all do a compulsory English language course for the years they are there. Strunk was in charge of such a course at an American university. He emphasized the importance of not wasting words, of conciseness, of precision. In fact, Strunk was so successful that his students put it on record that he frequently came towards the end of his lecture time and had nothing further to say. So he sat gazing fixedly at his students for the remaining 10 minutes, quarter of an hour, or whatever it was. And I sometimes think that some of my students may have been, without being aware of it, of course, given an example of Strunk's influence in a somewhat similar manner. Well, perhaps because of the influence of Strunk, perhaps because of my Yorkshire background, I normally don't talk anything like as much as this. But this, of course, is a very extraordinary occasion. So we always emphasize the importance of an introduction, a middle and an end in writing essays and composing one's remarks, and the end is frequently the most difficult. So, I better draw to an end, as Shakespeare says somewhere. How to do it? I could, of course, say, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for your gift, and I wish you well. But I always think "I wish you well" sounds very stilted, and it always sounds to me as if the person uttering it really meant "God help you." So I won't say that, because even if those were my sentiments, I shouldn't want to express them. I could, of course, as an English master, perhaps venture on a recitation. Mr. Harvey, on one or two occasions, has asked me to declaim, "Alas, poor Yorick, a fellow of infinite jest and fancy." It might suit the occasion, but I don't think I'll do that either. Or, of course, I might go on to "Farewell, a long farewell to all my greatness." Looking round this hall and remembering dramatic performances for which I was responsible, Hancock, superb as a miser on the stage, Fawcett refreshing himself behind the scenes from a bottle which he alleged contained a throat elixir, but which smelt suspiciously like alcohol to me. and displaying his talents very well upon the stage. I could go on for a long time about my dramatic experiences. And I see, by the way, that there's a meeting tomorrow for people interested in school drama. I do hope that becomes a living thing again, as it used to be. I don't think there's anything really more valuable for people in school and taking part in plays. The actors get an enormous amount out of it. I know, because I used to be very prominent in school drama myself as a boy. One of my contemporaries, in fact, went onto the professional stage and is now heard occasionally in his gruff Yorkshire voice advertising a certain kind of soup. His name is Leslie Sands. He appeared in a number of television productions, and I used to act with him on the stage in Bradford all that time ago. Bradford, well, that's a way to end it, isn't it? Because up there, let's go back to the traditional ways of that remarkable city. Remarkable, of course, nowadays, because by an extraordinary stroke of fate, all the buildings which were once sooty black have turned white, and all the inhabitants, or most of them, have wiped out black. Well, J.B. Priestley, who is, of course, the patron saint of all Bradfordians, whenever his name is mentioned, we metaphorically, or indeed literally on some occasions, bow the knee in homage, describes somewhere in one of his writings two Bradfordians parting, and, of course, the scene is Exchange Station, Bradford. It's a wet day, the water's dripping through the roof and collecting in puddles on the stone flags of the platform. One stands on the platform with his hands in his raincoat pockets looking up at the other, who leans out of a railway carriage window looking down. There's been the usual desultory exchange of remarks. There's a dreadful gap, and then the doors bang as the porters move along the platform and the guard unfurls his flag, and the chap in the carriage says to the one on the platform, "Oh well, best be off. Take care of this end." So I'll just say that. Ladies and gentlemen, best be off. Take care of this end.